Hello, everyone. Welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. If this is your first time at Skype a Scientist Live, welcome. Skype a Scientist is a nonprofit, and we match up scientists with classrooms, scout troops, library book clubs, groups of adults, people at old folks' communities, like any group of people that wants to talk to a scientist, we will match you up for free. And so if you want that to happen in your family or group of friends, you can do that at Skype a Scientist. But today we're going to be talking all about artificial intelligence and machine learning with Janelle Shane. She is the author of the book, You Look Like a Thing and I Love You, which I read a couple months ago and I laughed out loud during like many times because it's a very funny approach to a topic that to some may seem dry, but it wasn't dry. It's very funny and I'm really excited to talk to Janelle today. So would you like to introduce yourself, say who you are, what you do, and why you like it? And then audience members, get those questions in using the Q&A function at the bottom, and then we'll get to your questions after that brief intro.
Sure. So my name is Janelle Shane, and I run a blog called AIweirdness.com, and it's a machine learning humor blog, so looking at weird stuff that artificial intelligence does or can't really do. And then I also wrote a book, which is this bright neon green thing behind me called You Look Like a Thing and I Love You. And it's got like cartoons and all kind of just the basics on machine learning, artificial intelligence, how that all works. And I like working on that stuff because it is weird in a way that makes me think again about how my own brain works and how I understand the world and how the ways that I understand the world, you know, aren't necessarily a given. And there's different ways of interpreting stuff, especially if you don't have a lot of the same background. So I really like seeing my own world, my own brain reflected back to me in very strange ways.
Awesome. So before we really get into it, could you just tell us, like, to someone who has never thought about this stuff before, what is machine learning and what is artificial intelligence? Like, and where are the crossover points between those two and all that?
Yeah, so artificial intelligence is kind of the broadest term because it means so many things depending on who's talking. So we've got AI in science fiction, and those are often things that are as smart or smarter than people. And then we have what we call AI in real life, and it is a lot less smart. Like, these are the kinds of things that are like filtering your photos, like adding, like turning your face into like a cat and a Snapchat filter, or, you know, transcribing your voicemails, things like that. And that's a way different thing. And what we are calling artificial intelligence today mostly is a specific kind of computer program called a machine learning algorithm. And what's special about machine learning programs is that they don't learn by being given step-by-step instructions on how to solve a problem. Like, that's most of our programming, is you have a programmer who sits down, knows exactly how to solve a problem, and writes it down in exact detail for the computer to follow along step-by-step. With machine learning, it goes a bit differently. You give the computer program the goal. Like, you're supposed to, you know, learn how to predict the words that come next to a sentence, or you're supposed to learn how to categorize these two sorts of photos. And once you give it the goal, then it has to figure out for itself how to solve this problem via trial and error. And so sometimes it can come up with solutions to problems that we don't really know how to write down step-by-step instructions for. And sometimes it can come up with really weird shortcut solutions to problems that we weren't really expecting.
Cool. So could you tell us why, like, where You Look Like a Thing and I Love You, that phrase, where that came from?
Sure. Yeah. So that was from one of the experiments I did for my blog, where I wanted to see if I could get an algorithm, machine learning algorithm, to generate pickup lines. And so pickup lines, if you're probably familiar with these are like these cheesy one-liners that you would use to pick someone up at a bar or something like that. And I mean, they're generally like, they're just terrible. Like the puns are terrible, or some of them are just kind of gross. But fortunately, I discovered that the algorithm I was using was not nearly smart enough to pick up on any of that. And so what came out were these sort of things that made no sense, you know, or they were completely garbled and kind of made sense, but they're definitely not something a human would write. And one of these lines, my favorite line, was, "You look like a thing and I love you."
I love that. That's so funny. If someone said, "You look like a thing and I love you," to me, I'd be like, I think I need to know more. I think I need to dig into whatever the heck this person's talking about a little more. That's great. So what are some things that your everyday person walking down the street might think that artificial intelligence is doing that it would totally fall flat on its face if we actually tried to get AI to do it?
Yeah, so one of the some of the most classic things that we really want AI to do are things that it has a lot of trouble with. So, you know, robot butler, that's a classic sort of science fiction AI thing. Like, who wouldn't want a robot to do all of your household chores? Yeah. But then you look at the reality, like, there's lots of people who would pay money to have a robot clean your house. And what we have is like the Roomba, which gets stuck in a closet and sends plaintive text messages, "Help, I am stuck on the edge of a cliff," or something like this. So, you know, that's where the state of the art really is. Just doing something like folding a shirt. There was a paper that came out recently where they had, with a lot of trouble and expense, finally designed a robot that could fold a t-shirt, but it had to be a specific t-shirt and you had to give the t-shirt to the robot, and it would take a long time, like a full minute or something like this, to fold a t-shirt and forget jeans or long sleeve shirts or something. So that, yeah, so that's one of the things that machine learning algorithms really can't do. You know, meal delivery is another one of those. So sometimes you'll see these meal delivery robots that, you know, they're like a box with a whole bunch of wheels with treads on them, and they go down the street and, you know, they have food inside. But what they don't really advertise when they say, "We've got these robots," is that there is somebody remotely driving this robot from point to point, like said, looking at the camera picture and setting waypoints for it to drive between. And yeah, there's a lot of machine learning going on under the hood. Like, there's some AI figuring out how to actually like route between those points, but there is a human basically remote driving that car. And then of course, to get the food into that robot, there was a human on the other end who was picking up the food from the restaurant and putting in, because these all are really tough tasks for artificial intelligence to do. So yeah, there's a lot of things that we think AI can do now that it really can't, and a lot of that is secretly done by humans, which is weird and fascinating.
Yeah. I never would have known that those little food delivery robots were just like a person using a joystick. That's wild. Okay, so you've got a question from Gavin. What grades would you recommend your book to?
Ooh, good question. So there, because it's full of cartoons, I have had six-year-olds loving it. And people have sent me pictures of like their 10-year-old sleeping next to the book. And so I think really you can get a lot of it, lot out of this book early on, even if you're not really into computers yet, because this really assumes you have no background in computers. And then you'll get something else out of it if you have used some of these algorithms, like maybe you have a smartphone or have used a smartphone or have encountered some of these things. So, but it's designed so that you could start reading it in elementary school and still get some stuff out of it. And then I've got fans who are machine learning researchers themselves who say they really enjoyed the book. So that's what I set out to do, and hopefully manage that.
Awesome. Casey wants to know, what has been your favorite project so far?
Oh, goodness. That changes a lot just based on whatever I'm into. Right now, there's a project going on where I have released a bunch of drawing prompts. So hashtag Boptober is a sort of October drawing prompt sort of thing. And what I love about this is that people are taking these weird drawing prompts that I generated with using a machine learning algorithm. You got things like, oh, why don't you draw a picture of a four-dimensional object, or shadow puppetry performed in complete darkness, or a farm animal with purple spots on it. And people are drawing them. And there's some really fantastic art and some really creative ideas. So I really like to see that kind of back and forth between, we took something human, we made it weird with the help of one of these algorithms that doesn't really understand the human thing, and then humans are taking it and reflecting the weirdness back and creativity and like just taking it and running with it. I love that.
That's awesome. I love that too. Gavin would like to know, what script is most AI written in?
If you're looking to get into doing coding, your own coding, then Python is a really good overall all around thing to know. Like whether you go into coding or whether you're going to go into like more engineering work. Yeah, I would say number one is Python. There's a lot of other languages under the hood and a lot of other languages you can program in, but that would be the number one to learn to start with.
Sounds good. Rob would like to know, can you expand a bit on how human biases, including sexism, racism, et cetera, can be translated into AI contexts?
Sure. So this comes from the fact that these algorithms don't really understand what the world is, how the world works, and what we're actually asking them to do. Because there, you know, we talk about these computer programs solving problems, but they are really limited compared to our own brain. So they're working with whatever we've given them, and they don't understand like societal problems or history or anything like that. And then what compounds that is that we have to give them our specific task, and we tell them to, in most cases, we think we're asking them to predict something, like to predict who will be the best candidate for a job, for example. But what we're really asking them to do is copy the humans. So copy human decisions that humans have made in the past. And so the algorithm, of course, doesn't know that not all of these decisions were fair in the past. Yeah. And it's just trying to do its best to do exactly what the humans do, because that's what it's being rewarded for. So it'll actually figure out how to implement things like sexism and racism, and we'll be really sneaky about it too. And that's what makes it hard to catch too. So if you don't tell it, for example, you know, what gender your applicants are, the program can still do things like look at word choice in a resume and figure out, oh yeah, you know, this particular group of applicants tends to phrase things like this, or tends to go to these colleges, maybe they're women's colleges, or tends to be on women's softball teams. And we've seen evidence that these algorithms, I mean, they're just trying to do a good job. They're just trying to copy the humans, and they see this really strong signal like, boy, this is a tough problem, but if we, you know, go for this set of applicants over this set of applicants every time, we'll be a better imitation of the humans. And, you know, that's how it happens. It's copying human behavior, learning from the human world, and, you know, repeating history because it doesn't know itself what to change.
Right. There's that saying in computer science, garbage in, garbage out. And if humans are garbage,
yeah,
and
it's
they
us.
Do
it's
things,
all us.
Then
yeah,
the computer.
It's us. It's our fault.
It's our fault.
Yeah.
Well, let's try to be less garbage in the future.
Yeah, there are things we can do.
Yes, that's good. The next question is, how do you think artificial intelligence will evolve in the future?
Ooh, so that's an interesting one. You know, there's the really far future where we start to talk about the stuff we see in science fiction now, and we start to look at, you know, maybe there could be computer programs that could think like people and maybe have an inner life and be sentient. I love reading about that in science fiction. I don't think we're going to get there, at least not anytime soon, probably not in any of our lifetimes. So I think for the foreseeable future, we're going to have these computer programs that are very limited in what they can do and do best at really narrow problems. And so I think we'll see a lot more of these kind of AI-powered tools that we may not even realize are AI because they just kind of work. You know, that's one of the sayings about AI is that it ceases to be AI when it is actually working. So we don't think about our email filters being AI, or we don't think about our cameras, autofocus or lighting changes being AI, but a lot of this is being powered by machine learning algorithms. And, you know, our camera phones are way better at taking pictures than they have any right to be based on like the optics in there. It's right. Amazing. So I think we'll be seeing more sophisticated, more seamless sort of on the fly photo editing, transcribing voicemails, transcribing videos, detecting text and pictures and being able to reproduce that. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot of these little tools creeping into our everyday life pretty much without us noticing it. I think we're also going to be seeing some cases where we're really going to have to fight back against some irresponsible uses of AI. So people trying to use AI in ways that are unfair. So if you're taking a test and there's something that's trying to monitor you for cheating, like some universities or, you know, bar exams have had required programs like this. And, you know, it's unfair for people whose faces, their eye movements or facial movements may not match what's neurotypical, or, you know, we have strong evidence that these programs don't work as well on people with dark skin, and that's a real problem. And so I think as people learn more that these programs aren't perfect and that there are things that we can say and do to say, hey, wait, you know, let's stop using these programs. This is unacceptable. I think we're going to be seeing more and more activism against these bad uses of AI and more victories as well. So we're seeing some communities that are banning facial recognition, for example. So I think we'll see more communities engaging on what we want AI to be able to do or not to be able to do.
Right.
Man, I had no idea that these tests, like cheating softwares, were looking at our faces and trying to detect cheating in our faces. Like,
yeah, so you get crazy. People, yeah. So I guess they don't want people, like, looking. I don't know specifically what they're looking for. If they don't want you like opening up a new window or like talking to someone, I don't even know. But imagine trying to take that test and you have kids and the kids are, you know, doing stuff, or your cat does something, you know, it not everybody has a distraction-free environment where they can keep their eyes glued to the screen. And then, you know, back to the problem of this algorithm not being good at detecting some faces or some, you know, facial expressions and making mistakes. And so you get some people who, you know, have to shine bright lights into their faces the entire time they're taking a test, and it's stressful, and it's awful. So don't require people to use them.
Good. Very useful tip. Well, on a lighter note, I can see one. Okay, this question says, I am sure I see two giraffes in your frame. How many giraffes are in frame? And can you tell us like what the deal is with the giraffe thing?
Yeah, so AI has it's a bit of a running joke in AI at this point that it tends to report giraffes in cases where it's not quite sure what it's seeing. And this can be because in the training examples, there's a lot more pictures with giraffes in them than there are giraffes in real life, really. You know, you're in AI, there's much, you're quite more likely to have like a giraffe in a scene than just a scene of straight of like plain trees with nothing in it. Like, who's gonna upload that picture to, you know? So we get these cases where giraffes just kind of pop up in machine captions. And then you get researchers who are now using giraffes as a sort of a joke in their algorithms. Well, you know, if we've got a robot hand that's moving a Rubik's cube around, let's do a plush giraffe perturbation test and have the giraffe poking at the hand to see if the hand will drop the Rubik's cube. So we've got this giraffe here, and there are many giraffes in this book as well. So I don't know if you want to count visible, invisible giraffes.
All the giraffes. When in doubt, the computer will tell you there's a giraffe. That's really cool. That's funny. Okay, so the next question is, do you have any ideas you wish you could implement, but we don't have the technology yet?
Ooh, there's so many fun things that, you know, it would be fun to be able to generate images from scratch from captions. So right now you can kind of do it, like if you type out, you know, a giraffe is standing on a pizza or something, there are programs that will attempt to render into that caption, but the giraffe is like some weird giraffe textured smear, and the pizza is just like this sea of pepperoni kind of blobs, and it's not photorealistic, it's not really even recognizable. But to be able to like type out a description and have something generate a picture that matches this description and does the thing that you describe. It doesn't have to do it perfectly, because not perfect is interesting. You know, a lot of computer generated imagery is like, yes, that is a clock, but it has too many hands and the letters aren't really legible. And also it is sort of melting and blobbing out into a new clock. Like, there's some really cool machine learning, machine generated imagery, but you can't really make a video out of it now, and you can't really make things to order quite yet. But that would be exciting. I would love to play a bit more with that.
Awesome. The next question is, what are some of the most recent AI/ML, so artificial intelligence / machine learning projects you have worked on? Your bio mentioned a virtual reality arena for mantis shrimp.
Oh, so that's my other hat. So in addition to doing this blog, this is I work full-time as a research scientist in optics. So I work in the lab that has like lasers in it, and we do projects building optical systems, usually for other research labs. So I actually don't use AI in that work right now. I've not come up against a problem that really needs AI, but I've done some cool stuff. And the virtual reality arena for mantis shrimp, this was a design that we were working on to try and make a screen that could actually tax the visual abilities of these shrimp. Because these shrimp have vision that, you know, it goes way farther into the ultraviolet, it goes way farther into the infrared, so there's a lot more colors of light that its eyes are sensitive to than ours are. And there's also like different kinds of light, like you can see polarized light, different kinds of polarization, like there's weird stuff that it can see according to how we know its eyes are built, but we don't know what these shrimp really perceive. Like, Can they use this information? Can they react to it? Do they even know that their eyes are detecting this? Mm-hmm. And so this was to design a screen that they could look at that would show little dots moving in different colors or with different polarizations to see, okay, can they tell that something is moving around? Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about mantis shrimp is that you can tell when they see something because they're hunting animals. And so their favorite video is the video of the small dot that moved across the screen, because they're like, prey, kill, kill. And they have these eyes that are on stalks as well, and they're independently moving eyes. And so if they see something that they want to kill, which is basically anything, then their eyes will lock in and track it. And so you can know that they've seen your little dot on the screen because they all of a sudden kill, kill, kill.
That's true. Mantis shrimp scare me a little bit. I mean, they're beautiful on screen, particularly the peacock one, which is the one that most people have seen, like the really, really, really colorful one. But when I'm out collecting squid, I see this different kind of mantis shrimp that's like this big, and green, and has like these punchers that are like kind of like just scary looking basically, and you'll see these like holes in the sand that are like this big, and then I'll just look into them, and sometimes the mantis shrimp will like come out, and yeah, these like eyes that are like kind of oval shaped but on stalks, and you see it just like sizing you up, and it is very scary. And I know it's like much, much smaller than me, but like, never trust a mantis shrimp, you know?
No, they're, yeah. The lab that I was working with won't work with mantis shrimp that are bigger than this, because after that, they get too dangerous. Because, I mean, their nickname is thumb splitters, and you can't keep them in regular aquarium glass once they get bigger, because they will punch through the aquarium glass. I mean, and even these ones, like, they are kept in little floating Tupperware containers, like within a larger tank, you know, as a holding area, so they don't kill each other. And they have to replace those Tupperwares from time to time because the shrimp will punch them gradually.
Mantis shrimp are wild. Okay, but let's get back to the computers, because if you start me on marine invertebrates, it's like we go down a hole. Let's see. So how can you tell if something is artificial intelligence or not? Or does everything electronic have some kind of artificial intelligence in it?
Yeah, that gets a little tough to tell sometimes, because you'll get companies that won't necessarily say they're using machine learning. They're just like, use our app, here's what it does. And they don't tell you exactly how it does it. Like, it could do something that it might be doing something that you could do with machine learning, but maybe they found a more efficient way to do it just by writing down step-by-step rules. That happens. Or in other cases, they say, yay, we've got this new AI app. And then when you actually look at how it does it, you're like, oh, that's not machine learning, or that is secretly a human remote controlling whatever it is, or, you know, you're image is getting sent to a person who then, you know, transcribes whatever they're seeing and sends it back. So it can be really tough to tell if there's AI powering stuff. Like, there's some applications right now that are almost entirely AI. So if you have something that's doing real-time translation, for example, and there's not like a translator sitting there, or there's something that's doing real-time transcription and, you know, they don't tell you that there's a person and it's making a lot of mistakes, that's probably AI. There's a lot of AIs being used for those. But yeah, it's often just tough to tell.
Sounds good. The next question is AI actually spying on us?
There are definitely people who can use AI programs to spy on us. So facial recognition, that's one of the things that is pretty much entirely done by AI. But the AI is not itself, you know, it does a narrow piece of the problem. So it does the try and match this face to something in our database. And then it's a person who decides what to do with that and decides whether it's a match and, you know, what do they do with that information? Or maybe they tie it into another program that figures out what ad to deliver to somebody.
Sounds good. The next question is, considering the growth of artificial intelligence, how far are we to the age of synthetic humans walking around among us?
You'll get different answers to that question depending on who you talk to. The reason I say that we probably won't see it in our lifetime is because I'm, you know, I see that we have a long history of thinking that human level AI is right around the corner, because I think we don't realize yet just how smart people are and how hard it is to design something that's that smart. So I also, like in my job as an optics researcher, I work with neuroscientists who are trying to study the way human brains work. And there's all of this complexity to human brains that we don't understand at all yet. Like we don't, there's these extra levels of signaling, extra levels of feedback, and like coordination between human brain cells that we don't even understand yet. And our computer programs are nowhere near that complex. And I think it's just a really tough, really, really tough problem. You know, we've got examples of people who do machine learning, who do AI for a living, and they still get tripped up from time to time by trying to make an AI application that it turns out AI is nowhere near smart enough for yet. So for example, to be a virtual assistant, and they had this pilot project called Facebook M that was supposed to be able to, you know, arrange for movie tickets and call up businesses and answer questions about anything. And it was just too tough a problem, as it turns out. Like they kept having to have remote humans step in and rescue the AI from its confusion. And they ended up saying, you know, we're never going to be able to do this without humans. This is not going to be profitable. So I think we as humans have this pattern. Like this, we have a weird idea of what's hard and what's not hard as well. So we think like, oh, chess, very difficult. Very smart people play chess. That must be a hard problem. And then AI kicks our butt at chess and we're like, AI must be smarter than people. Right. But no, it's just chess happens to be a problem that is easy to, relatively easy to solve with a computer. And then we turn around and we say, all right, you know, folding laundry, that must be an easy thing to do. We're not going to pay people who do that very much. That's, you know, low skilled job. And then you try to get a computer to do it and the computer can't at all. So I think that's a pattern. We humans have way more brains, way more complexity than we give ourselves credit for sometimes.
Yeah, we're so good at things that we think that they're easy, but they're not easy. They're hard. Yeah. And we're just not giving enough credit for the amazing feat of folding a t-shirt. That's right. Cool. All right, so we've got a question from a student, and you may have to explain the question after, because I don't know what quantum computers are, but can quantum computers be used to create perfect artificial intelligence? And then for your squid biologist host, what the heck is a quantum computer?
So a quantum computer is a particular type of computer. Right now, they're pretty experimental, so they're solving really particular kinds of problems. The ones people are finding most interesting right now have to do with cracking codes or have to do with encrypting messages. And quantum computers are really hard to build right now. So we don't, and they're not better than regular computers at other certain kinds of tasks. So it's tough to say right now if there's something about artificial intelligence that's really going to be helped once we have better and more complex quantum computers, or, you know, if AI is really best done by the regular sort of computers. Like, I don't think we know that yet.
Cool. That's a fun mystery for us to solve in the future. We've got a question from Veer. Is there any danger to humans from AI in the future? We've already talked about how basically we can create AI that is as racist as humans, but are there any other dangers that we should be thinking about?
Yeah, so I think the danger we really have to worry about is the one you just mentioned, where we have algorithms that are being used in ways that are harmful or ways that are, you know, hurting people or putting people out of a job or, you know, reinforcing some bad stuff that our society does. I think that's the main danger that we're facing like right now. You have people whose lives are already being made difficult by algorithms, and that is a danger that I think we're going to have to continue fighting against.
Absolutely. When did AI really start? Like, when did we get our first artificial intelligence?
The things that are machine learning algorithms, they actually go back a long way toward the beginnings of computers. So even back when people were first building computers, if you look back to the 1960s, there were already people who were thinking about how can we simulate some of the stuff that human brain cells do? How can we simulate that with a computer program? And so a lot of the earliest papers go back that far. Machine learning is about as old as computers are. We've just been seeing more of it commercially now because we've got now computers that can run these applications, and we've got some better programming tools that finally make it, you know, commercially profitable. And that's where you see a lot of this interest coming from all of a sudden.
Right. So are there any laws that are being developed that are like intelligently and appropriately like keeping artificial intelligence in check in terms of being dangerous for us?
Yeah, there are people working on this and working hard on it. You know, it is tough for lawmakers who don't have this kind of background. So I think there's some catch up involved where we're seeing things right now that are being rolled out that, you know, may be implementing discrimination, and someday soon they're going to be, you know, they're not going to be allowed anymore. But we've kind of got this period right now where some things are getting through. We are seeing, you know, I mentioned facial recognition being banned in certain areas. So that is one case where we have laws that are already being passed to limit what you can do with AI and the kinds of harms that it can cause.
Sounds good. Gavin would like to know, are things with AI really only built to do one or two things, or are they built to do a huge variety and number of things?
Oh, so yeah, today's AI is narrow artificial intelligence. So it is best at doing just one thing at a time. So, you know, you have one program on your phone that transcribes your voicemail, or you have one program that can turn your face into like an anime version of your face. Right. And then there's another, you know, within that same program, if you want to turn into a cat instead, like that is a different program that does that, like a whole different algorithm, you know, and it may be have a lot of similarities in the method they use for training the algorithm, but they're separate little boxes. So yeah, it is very much a case of we have an algorithm that can do just one narrow thing. And the broader we try to make its task, the more it tends to have trouble, just because there's only so much it can do.
Sounds good. So one last question before we end with our like final two questions that we ask everybody. How did you get into science writing, and like how did you go from being a researcher during the day to researcher by day, author by night? Like how did that all happen?
I started a blog. That's the short answer. Like I saw somebody playing around with artificial intelligence, generating recipes using one of these algorithms. And I thought they were hilarious. I needed to learn to do that. And then once I had generated some of my recipes, I have to show people, at least my friends and family. So I made a blog, put that stuff on there. And to my surprise, other people started thinking this was interesting too, and started visiting my blog. But that's where it started. It was me wanting to do something because it was going to make me amused, and then me sharing it in case anybody else thought this was interesting too.
That's awesome. Because yeah, I think like one thing that generally speaking, scientists need to lean into more is just like where they're having a good time, like where they're having fun. And so it doesn't have to go directly to your H index or whatever. So like basically the things that will get you tenure and promotions and all that kind of thing for folks who aren't familiar with academia, like just do what's fun for you, and beautiful things can come of it, like writing a book and making people happy. And that's really awesome. I'm so glad you wrote your book because it brought me joy. So thank you.
Yeah, and you don't, thanks. And I should point out, you don't have to wait till you have formal training or till you're like a scientist working in that area or whatever, you know, especially with machine learning, you don't need expensive equipment to get started. You can get started experimenting with stuff, make your own blog. It's cheap. You can learn as you go. You can learn stuff that you need specifically to do what you yourself are finding entertaining. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot to be said for learning that way and for doing exactly what you want to do. You know, yeah, you can do it now.
That's so true. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so we've got two final questions for you. The first is, what is one thing that you wish everybody in the world knew about your area of expertise?
Ooh, I would say I wish people knew that these programs make mistakes, that they aren't smart like humans are. Right. So I think there's a lot of confusion that comes from that. And people are like, well, you could just tell the program not to be racist, or just tell the program to make a moral decision, like tell it to value human life. And right. Well, I can't understand that. You know, yeah.
Yeah, good. That's a solid thing for us all to know. The next thing, next question is, if you could tell everybody in the world one thing about literally anything, it can be as like big picture important or silly and small as you'd like, what do you tell everybody?
Gosh, everybody in the entire world.
Yes.
Man, that's just too overwhelming. The thing that comes to mind right now is, have you read the Murderbot books? They're so good.
Okay.
Like, yeah, that's my very minor panic PSA is, you probably would enjoy reading these books about Murderbot. It's like short science fiction. The bot is, you know, secretly given itself free will, but just wants to watch TV. But it's also like deadly and has guns in its arms, and they're so delightful. Yeah,
I will.
That's what I'm thinking of. That's what came to mind right now.
Perfect.
Because I'm sitting in front of my bookcase.
Perfect. That sounds great. That's good. Okay. Do you have anything that you would like to plug? Places we can find you on social media? Any other places that you'd like us to go check out? This is your opportunity.
Well, you can find me on Twitter as Janelle C. Shane, and you know, the Boptober project I mentioned with the drawing prompts. If you want to draw some of the weird things, then that hashtag is Boptober. And you know, I'm on Instagram and Mastodon as well. You can find me there. My blog is AIweirdness.com, and my book, which just fell on the floor, is You Look Like a Thing and I Love You. So if you are know someone who's maybe interested in this stuff, I had a lot of fun writing it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. This was super fun for me. And Erin, thank you for signing for us as always. And for everybody, next week, we're going to be doing all neuroscience. So we're going to be talking to three neuroscientists, all from the Philadelphia area, because there's a group in Philly that does neuroscience and reached out to us and wanted to partner, so we're doing it. And so look forward to that. You'll find all that information on skypeascientist.com. And also, if you can support us, if you're new to Skype a Scientist, please sign up for a session for yourself. If you are interested in sharks, you can get matched with a shark scientist. If you're interested in computer science, you can get matched with any number of computer scientists. And so please check that out. Take advantage of our program. It's totally free. And if you'd like to support our work, you can do that at patreon.com/skypeascientist. Thanks for coming today. Thank you again, Janelle and Erin, and we'll see you all next week.
Thank you.
Bye.